From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, ratifying the American Constitution. That's the topic this week on Soundings. My guests are two visitors at the National Humanities Center, Michael Lenish of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Michael Gillespie of Duke University. Both Michael Lenish and Michael Gillespie recently participated in a conference at the center entitled Ratifying the Constitution, Ideas and Interests in the Several American States. This discussion is one in a series of programs on the bicentennial of the United States Constitution. Here is Michael Lenish.
Well, we don't think much. We tend not to think much about ratification these days. We think a lot about the Constitution. We have a tendency to talk a lot about our fabled founding fathers who met together during that long, hot summer in Philadelphia and who created this miraculous Constitution. And that's all very important. But we miss what goes along with that, which was the fact that once this thing was created, it had to be made real, it had to be ratified. The framers of the Constitution gave us the skeleton. What the ratifiers did was really put meat on its bones. Once these 55 signers sent the Constitution out, it then had to be debated by almost 2,000 delegates who met in 13 states over a period of, well, what was really 3 years. Mm-hmm. Ratification really tells us what the Constitution is. The creators, framers, founders created it, but the ratifiers explained it.
Was it a tough fight? Mike Lenish began by saying that we look back and we see this sort of monolithic historical inheritance, and we don't really understand some of the shades of gray and the fights that went on. Michael Gillespie, help me with that. How close a contest was it?
Well, I think Mike Lenish just mentioned the miracle of the formation of the Constitution. I think the real miracle, in fact, was the ratification. It was not merely a close contest. It was a contest that really should, by all rights, have been lost. Hmm. And it was a contest that was won, I think, by a whole variety of factors. It began quite auspiciously with five states ratifying by very large majorities, often unanimously, and with little debate. When the Constitution came to Massachusetts, however, things took on a different shape. It was generally recognized, I think, that if Massachusetts, New York, and Virginia didn't ratify, all three of them, that the Constitution simply would not come to be.
Those were what? Somehow key states, I take it.
Those were the key states. They were generally the largest states, certainly the politically most important states. Mm-hmm. If any one of those were not to ratify, it was fairly clear the Constitution would fail, and the mm-hmm. United States, in fact, probably would have broken down into a series of sectional confederacies.
Why is that? Be specific for me.
This is a people who had just, less than 10 years before, fought a revolution, a very bloody revolution, indeed, we forget that, against political power, against centralized power, against monarchy and aristocracy. And while the Constitution was neither monarchical nor aristocratic, there was a lot of power there. Uh-huh. It was a document designed to give power to a central government.
And people,
that was the whole point.
People, I take it, were very wary of that kind of power. Michael Gillespie?
Well, yeah, I think Mike's absolutely correct about that. And the important thing that we tend to forget is the distances involved at that point. The revolution, in part, was a response to the fact that authority was so distant from the people, that there was taxation without representation, but that even with representation, representatives would have had to travel weeks and months simply to reach the center of political authority. I think the system that the Constitution set up looked very much like this to the colonists of that time. Travel from a state as distant as North Carolina, where we are today, to a seat of authority, which would probably have been either in New York or Philadelphia, was very, very difficult. Indeed, we can say from our own perspective today, the only thing that is as far away from us as the center of authority would have been then is the moon. Hmm. So that we have to keep in mind the desire for a Republican government among Americans of this period, which meant to them a government that was close to them, that they could have some sort of control over. They were really suspicious of whether that would be the case with a national government of the sort that was proposed.
Mm-hmm. Mike Lenish.
Yeah, I think that's right. And in addition to that, along with that, there's just the factor of newness. The Constitution was something like, well, no one had ever seen before. And the fact was that while times weren't great, this was a people who had won its independence, and they were governing themselves, and there were state constitutions, and there was a national government such as it was, and a lot of people weren't convinced that they needed this new unknown plan in the first place.
Let's be specific, Michael Gillespie and Mike Lenish. Pick an issue for me that would have been, you know, something at the heart of the ratification debate. You've talked about the centralization of power. Is there a way in which regional North versus South interests would illustrate that kind of thing? I'm thinking, for example, of the religious factor. New England is an area that at that time comes to us today very much under the imprint of Puritanism. Would things like that have entered into the ratification debate, or were they sort of tangential? I'm presenting you with a number of options here. Michael Gillespie?
Well, let me just speak to the question of religion. I mean, I think nothing is so indicative of the differences about religion than the debates in North Carolina and in New Hampshire. In New Hampshire, there was a claim made by many of the people that were opposed to the Constitution that it didn't go far enough. That indeed, what was needed was a religious test for office to make sure that such strange burgess papists and the like would not be allowed to serve in the government. Whereas in North Carolina, people were very concerned that a religious test would be imposed. So I think that one sees the real diversity of ideological and theological characteristics among the American people really playing themselves out on one level in the ratification debates.
What about, for example, commerce among and between the states? Was that something that people would get hot under the collar about? Why would they fight about it? It all seems so easy today. You know, we got freeways, we got money, we got banking machines all over the place. What was it like
back
then?
Well, one of the really salient issues, I think, and it is probably a sufficient explanation for the ratification of many of the smaller states, in particular, was that some of the major states, in particular, I think of New York, had an impost tax, which they charged on all goods coming into and passing through the state of New York. Therefore, that tax was ultimately paid, of course, by the consumers who lived in the smaller states who were served by New York, the port of New York. As a result, of course, those smaller states were paying taxes to support New York citizens. Therefore, this led to, as one can well imagine, great animosity, and led to a recognition by the smaller states that if they were to remain outside of a union, that they would undoubtedly be prey to the depredations of the larger states in these matters.
Mm-hmm. Mike Lenish.
Economics really worked in both directions. I think it provided a real inducement for a lot of the carrying states that were economically very active, especially those in the middle, to get into a larger national union. At the same time, it was just as important to opponents of the Constitution, many of whom were very happy with the kind of political economy that existed in their own states, where it was easy to get money and where loans were often canceled. They saw a central government implying hard money and tough credit for little guys as a real threat, a real economic threat.
Mm-hmm. Michael Gillespie?
Well, on the other hand, let me just say there was Rhode Island, infamous at the time for its law, which required payment of all debts owed to North Carolina, owed to Rhode Islanders in hard currency, and mandating that all Rhode Islanders should pay debts owed to citizens of other states only in paper money.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the people at our conference, John Kaminsky, pointed out, led many New Englanders, many New England Federalists to believe that Rhode Island was really an example provided by God of the necessity for a stronger federal government.
But I remember reading in your paper, for example, that that the Anti-Federalists really had lost the battle before the opening shot was fired. And it was on the grounds of, well, help me with this.
Well, I think there is a kind of hidden factor here. I mean, a factor that's so obvious that we miss it, and that is that the Federalists had the Constitution. They came to the debates with the Constitution in hand, and in that sense, they really set the agenda.
Tell me your sect, and I'll anticipate your argument.
Yeah, I think that's right. The Anti-Federalists, as a result, had a very hard row to hoe. They were immediately, I think, by definition, from the start, sort of placed on the defensive.
Mm-hmm.
They had to show what was wrong with it. They had to knock it apart. And in the end, I think that turned out to be a very difficult thing to do, not least because after a while there was a kind of momentum, I mm-hmm. suppose, to this thing. States ratified and then other states ratified, and by the time it came to the end, near the end, it seemed almost inevitable.
What would the states opposed to ratification have been left with in practical terms if, in fact, the ratification process had failed, for example, in North Carolina or in Delaware? They would have been what, independent but not sovereign entities, politically speaking, Mike Gillespie?
Well, it is after the Union did come into being, first with only 11 states, because Rhode Island and North Carolina had not yet ratified. Those states were ultimately treated as foreign states. Taxes were charged upon goods coming in and out of those states into the other states, and they were really left isolated. They did their very best to pay for the common defense and to maintain some connection with the rest of the states. And indeed, in one interpretation of the document, they still did remain in a confederacy under the Articles of Confederation, which were not simply annulled by the Constitution. At least that was their argument. The other. The government, however, moved very quickly to treat them more as independent sovereign states, largely, I think, however, simply to put more pressure on them to bring them into the Union.
Mm-hmm. What did the ratification process have to do with our then and now conceptions of citizenship? I remember reading in your papers that people like Samuel Adams were interested in, what did he call it, a Christian Sparta, civic virtue, moral education. Was the ratification itself important conceptually to the then understanding of things like that, as well as the way we look back today? Michael Gillespie?
Well, that was certainly the case in New England, and I think to a lesser extent in the other states, although I think North Carolina as well is very important in that regard. Sam Adams and I think John Hancock as well had a clear notion of a small moral republic, something he called, as you pointed out, the Christian Sparta, a republic in which people would be close to their representatives, in which there would be a clear moral standard that would be imposed. In the 1790s, for example, both Hancock and Adams struggled unsuccessfully, as it turned out, against the performance of theater in Boston, probably the first of band in Boston that we're so familiar with throughout the 19th century. Yeah. They were unsuccessful then. They were, especially in New England, they were very fearful that the Constitution would supplant their local institutions. And I point out that the Federalists themselves, those who favor the Constitution, thought of it as founding, in many respects, a commercial republic to replace this republic of virtue. They were very fearful that a republic of virtue spread over such a large area was simply unfeasible and might very well lead to the sorts of moral struggles that had been present in the English Civil War.
Factionalism.
Factionalism uh-huh. of an ideological sort, yeah. really, based upon religious differences, moral differences. Mm-hmm. Whereas they saw a commercial republic as resolving these problems and providing a basis on which all Americans could cooperate with one another, could trade, could found a new sort of life. The concern with commerce, however, meant less of a concern with government, less turning away from participatory politics into participation in commerce and trade and industry.
How did people talk about ratification? We didn't have television stations. We didn't have networks and satellites. We had, help me with this. How many newspapers were there on a scale of 1 to 10 by comparison with what we've got today? That isn't so much the issue as how people communicated with one another on this. Michael Gillespie?
Well, I think the presence of newspapers really varied a great deal between the states and both in East and West within the states. What was interesting in our conference was a paper by Don Lutz of the University of Houston, who pointed out that most newspapers were sold not to private individuals but to taverns, and that many people would come into the taverns and read the newspapers there, and even those people that couldn't read would often hear them read by others or hear them discussed by others. So that certainly in the New England states, and to a lesser extent in the other states, there was a fairly wide circulation of the news, much wider than one would think. Given
a wide awareness of the ratification, I take it.
I think that there was. The issue about literacy is important. It is true that far fewer people then could read than now.
But they could still talk.
Yes, but they could still talk. And moreover, they were part of what was really a much more public culture than ours. They spent their evenings in taverns most of the time, rather than at home in drawing rooms or in parlors. Mm-hmm. So it was that most of the public writing tended to be read aloud. It really was public, and what that meant was that people were, under the conditions, remarkably well educated. Mm-hmm. They knew what was going on.
Michael Gillespie and Mike Lenish, let me invite you to be anecdotal. You are political theorists. You are also historians after a fashion. Tell me a story. Name an issue coming out of the ratification of the Constitution. Michael Gillespie?
Well, it seems to me the incident that most has fascinated me is and what I think is the high point, actually, of the whole ratification process is John Hancock's entry into the ratification convention in Massachusetts. Hancock was a longtime sufferer of the gout and had absented himself from the convention, although elected as president, until very near the end. At this point, it was not clear which way the tide would turn for or against the Constitution. And Hancock had himself carried in on a litter wearing red flannel to the front of the convention to deliver his speech proposing the conciliatory position that secured the ratification. It was noted that he had a flair for the dramatic, and many people had thought that he had intentionally absented himself to wait and see which way the tide would turn. I think, nonetheless, it's pretty clear that his entrance had a tremendous impact upon the delegates, and I think ultimately was responsible for securing the ratification in Massachusetts, and I think, therefore, in many respects, in some of the other states as well.
That's a great story. Too bad we didn't have television to cover it then the way we do now. Mike Lenish?
Well, I think of the partisanship of the process. I think of early on of George Mason of Virginia, who was at Philadelphia and left saying that he would rather cut off his right hand than sign the Constitution of the United States. I think of Pennsylvania, where anti-federalist legislators, opponents of the Constitution, were kidnapped from their hotel boarding house rooms and dragged across the street screaming and kicking so there would be a quorum in order to call a convention, kidnapped by Federalists. And I think of North Carolina, where there was a full-fledged riot at one of the polling places in Kinston in Dobbs County, where things looked bad for the Federalists, and bad enough, in fact, that they, I guess, in effect, attacked the polling place. They knocked the lights out and
stole the polling boxes.
Stole the ballot box. knocked the sheriff senseless. threw the ballot box out in the backyard and scattered the ballots to the wind.
Uh-huh.
This was real politics back then. It was they played hardball.
It sounds like what we would see today in professional wrestling matches on our cable TV systems. Michael Gillespie.
Let me just bring up one more incident that seems to me to be of interest. That is Patrick Henry, the great old ideologue of the revolution in the Virginia ratifying convention. Henry, after his first speech, which lasted 6 hours, had completely entranced.
you'd only find that on C-SPAN these days, right? There's no way that would make the network news. I'm sorry.
Had completely entranced the delegates with his rambling oratory to such an extent that one of the Federalists said, if this goes on, we'll be here for 3 or 4 years before we even come to a vote.
Goodness. Does the ratification continue today? You are professors at Duke and UNC Chapel Hill. This is pretty, well, if not arcane, specialized stuff. How is it important to us in the 1980s? Mike Lenish?
Well, I think it does continue. I mean, I think there's a real question as to how it is that we define ratification. Ratification took 9 months to get 9 states, as many as they needed to get the Constitution brought into effect. But beyond that, it took 3 years to bring in the rest of the states. And beyond that, it took 4.5 years before we had a Bill of Rights that was passed by the first Congress in 1791. And that's part of ratification, I think. And in that regard, I think, in some sense, the rest of the amendments, I think especially of the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments after the Civil War, which opened this whole process up. We said before that this was a process back then in the 18th century that was dominated by white males. The 14th Amendment changed that, as did woman suffrage. And so, in that regard, it seems to me that ratification, in a way, goes on today.
Do you think the American people are worthy of their principal governing document? Are we as ignorant as some of the statistics indicate? Do we deserve this Constitution that we've got, Mike Lenish?
Well, there's no question that we don't know much about it. We have a hard time distinguishing the Constitution from the Declaration of Independence. Most people don't know when it happened, when it was written.
Well, I'm not necessarily pushing for a lot of people to be able to stand up and recite dates or historical facts so much as just what a sort of constitutional culture that we may be somewhat deficient in. Michael Gillespie?
Well, I think it's certainly the case that most of the founders thought that the Constitution that they were creating in the new system of government they were putting together would make people less concerned with politics. They thought and this was a salutary fact, that it would turn them away from partisan politics towards economics, towards commerce, which would be, in the long run, much more stable.
So I'm being a little too harsh. In other words, we don't necessarily have to have some profound knowledge of the Constitution so much as just that it's there as a kind of framework and then we can get on with our lives.
I think that was certainly the framers' view. Now, whether or not that was correct, I think, remains to be seen. Uh-huh. I think that they certainly never, in their wildest imagination, would have thought of a people as little concerned with principles of government and as little concerned with politics as we are today. So I think in that sense, we may have to recover some of the salutary political concern that was so clear and evident in their own deliberations.
Mm-hmm. Mike, finish.
I think that's part of the problematic quality of the politics that comes out of the Constitution. there's a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, I suppose, that came with the Constitution. The Constitution was not really designed to inspire us to go out and to do politics. It was a more complicated kind of document than that. I think that Mike is right, that what we've come to focus on with the Constitution are elements that ultimately, I think, aren't very political. And by that I mean that today when we think of the Constitution, we don't think much about our responsibilities as citizens. What we think about is our rights.
Mm-hmm. Our privileges.
Yeah, our rights and our privileges, that's right. And I, of course, that's ironic because those rights came not out of the Constitution itself, but they came out of the ratification process. Again, the Bill of Rights came later. But what that suggests is that we've really become much more self-interested, I think, in our politics, more than, far more than these 18th century people could ever have imagined.
Uh-huh. Michael Gillespie?
Well, I'm really reminded of Benjamin Franklin at the close of the Federal Convention. This man, the grandfatherly figure of the convention, turned to Madison as they were signing the final document and told him that over the president's head during the convention he had seen a picture of a sun, and he had asked himself time and time again whether this was a rising sun or a setting sun, and he felt now in his heart that with the success of the Constitutional Convention that this was a rising sun and that America was a rising sun. I think it's important for us today to retain some of that political concern to make sure that it continues to be a rising and not a setting sun.
Michael Lenish and Michael Gillespie participated in a recent conference at the National Humanities Center on the ratification of the American Constitution. Michael Lenish and Michael Gillespie are co-editors of a forthcoming collection of essays entitled Ratifying the Constitution, Ideas and Interests in the Several American States. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Ratifying the Constitution, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about miracles in the modern world. My guests will be Thomas Heffernan of the University of Tennessee and Laureen Danforth of Bates College. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Ratifying the American Constitution, the topic this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center. According to scholars from the University of North Carolina and from Duke University, America nearly rejected its own principal political document in its infancy. Ratifying the Constitution, some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.